Welcome to Science Fiction 101, the podcast series where we look at the science fiction field from all angles, past, present, and future. I'm Phil.
And I'm Colin.
And today is the 21st of April, 2023. And we're going to be following up on our last episode by looking at our favourite science fiction TV shows. And we also have a quiz. I don't know if Colin knows we have a quiz, but we have a quiz. I've got one here. And our usual roundup of recommendations of past, present and future science fiction will be coming up at the end. Now, we've had some technical difficulties today in getting this recording going, so I'm hoping that the sound quality isn't too bad, but if it's slightly below our normal quality, I can only apologise and hope that normal service will be resumed next time. Well, we had some feedback on our last episode, quite a bit, actually. I was quite pleased by the number of people who were inspired to send us their lists of favourite movies. So let me just call up some of the comments here. Seth congratulated us on surviving the brutal quiz that we went through last time. And he also provided his movie list in no particular order. His favourite science fiction films, The Empire Strikes Back, Star Trek II, Sunshine, Galaxy Quest, Jurassic Park, Planet of the Apes, and he says, though I agree with basically everything Phil said about Escape from the Planet of the Apes, and then Aliens, The Prestige, Men in Black, and Serenity. And I have to admit, there are some films listed there that I had completely forgotten about, so I should redo my list now. Then we heard from Ivor, who said, enjoyable episode, good to hear some love for the Enemy Mine and Soldier movies. And he says, I still find something new in Alien when I watch it, and it still terrifies me. And Joe said, fun discussion. Like Phil, I rank the first Alien and Terminator ahead of their sequels, but was surprised he doesn't seem to like even T2 much, Terminator 2. And I replied to Joe that, well, yeah, Terminator 2 would be in my top 40, possibly my top 30. It's just that it didn't get in the top 10. And we also heard from Andy, who set the quiz. And he said, brilliant, glad you used the quiz. Sorry if it was overly complicated. And somebody called Colin replied saying, Andy, your quiz was fine. It was the contestants who were lacking. So there we go. And Andy also gave us his list of films, and he broke his down into categories. So best space opera, Star Wars, best comedy, Morons from Outer Space. Have you even heard of that one, Colin?
No.
No, it's a British comedy, and I'm astonished that anyone would include it in a list of their favourite films. But there you go. Then he has Time Travel, Back to the Future, Animated, Lightyear, Non-English, Kashan, I think it's pronounced, First Contact, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Dystopian Future, Elysium, Alien Action, Predator, Robot, Short Circuit, and AI, 2001, A Space Odyssey. So thank you, Andy, for your list. And again, there's some films I'd forgotten about in there. If you want to join in the dialogue, you can post comments on our blog at 101sf.blogspot.com, or you can find us on Facebook as Science Fiction 101 Podcast. So, last time we did films, this time we're going to do TV shows. And before we decided on this as a topic, I suggested that if we've got something like Star Trek, we can obviously treat each iteration of Star Trek as a separate thing. So the original series is a TV show, the Next Generation is a TV show, just so that we're able to put in multiple iterations if we choose. So, Colin, what sort of size of top 10 did you come up with for favourite TV shows?
Oh, my top 10, I think, actually has about 23 on it. let's stick to top 10. Something I've noticed is that I watch less television than I used to when I was younger, because my list is mainly filled with things that are 10 years old or older.
Interesting. Now, I found as I was doing it that I kept remembering things that were more recent, and I found that mine was getting very heavy with recent shows. I mean, subsequently, I pruned it down so that my top 10 literally contains 10. So mm-hmm. some of the items that I really wanted in the top 10, I've actually bumped out. I tell you what, though, I found it much harder to do this than to do favorite movies. Anyway, I think what we're saying is that what we're about to go through is not necessarily the best TV shows, but it's our personal favorites. So they're likely to be things that we would happily watch again and again.
Oh, definitely.
I did mine the same as I did films. I wrote them down as they came into my head, and then I've put them in chronological order because I cannot bring myself to name one show as being the number one show.
I wrote down everything I could think of, and mm-hmm. Then I tried to rank them, you know, top to bottom. So I have a what I really think is my favorite science fiction television show. And then it was hard to rank the rest because I like them all quite a bit. But I tried to think about things like, you know, would I sit down and watch the series again from beginning to end? If I catch it on television and I'm doing something else, does it grab my attention or is it just kind of sitting there in the background? Have I watched it more than once already?
That's a good test, isn't it? Something that you've been driven to go back to. Yeah. Do you want to throw in your first one?
Yes. And I'm going to say that, like you said, my top 10 are my top 10. They're my favorites. They're not necessarily the best, the most popular science fiction. And especially because my number 10 is the original Battlestar Galactica from the late 70s. I remember, I want to say the first two episodes were released as a movie.
Yeah, I think so.
With a soundtrack that you could buy. And then it was re-released on television.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it. I liked the mythology of the show. Not only that there was an in-show mythology, but it kind of mirrored, some Western, some Jewish mythology with the 12 tribes, and the special effects for the time were incredible. And I was young when I watched it, and so I think it probably impacted me more. But the space battles, I wanted to be a Viper pilot really badly.
And did you ever get the opportunity to do that?
Only in play, because my parents bought me an assemblable plastic model, not a Lego, but you know the old ones where you would put together a car or an airplane or a boat. I had the Viper model, and it fired little plastic darts.
Brilliant. That one is not on my list, and I think even if I did a top 100, I doubt if it would be there. But there's no shame in that. If you love it, you love it. First one on my list, because mine's chronological, mine is from 1958. And I very quickly want to say this is before my time. It's before I was born. But I've seen it in the years since because it survives. And it's 1958's BBC series Quatermass and the Pit. Obviously, I never saw it in first run because it was before I was born. It was from the days of live television, so it wasn't something that was easily repeatable. But it was something that growing up, my parents would refer to from time to time. So we'd be watching some other science fiction thing on the TV, and one of them, usually my dad, would say, "Oh, that's a bit like Quatermass." And so I grew up knowing that there was this thing called Quatermass without really having ever seen it, you know, because it was before my time. There were some films that were basically remakes of these BBC series, and they came out in the 50s and 60s, but I don't think I'd even seen those. But Quatermass and the Pit is the third Quatermass story, the third series. Mm-hmm. It was a series which was done more or less as live TV, because this was before proper videotape existed. But what they managed to do on Quatermass in the Pit is pre-film large amounts of it. So a lot of the action takes place in a location which is a London underground station that is being excavated, and they find what they think initially is a wartime bomb, but it turns out to be, spoilers, turns out to be an alien spaceship deep underground. And all of the action that takes place in the underground station was shot on film in a film studio and edited just like a film. So as a viewer, if you were watching it at home, you'd see actors performing live in like the professor's lab, and then they'd go off to the underground station, and at that point they would cut to film, the pre-filmed stuff. Now, all of this survives because recordings were made of the show. The live stuff looks a bit ropey because it was just done with very low definition television, but all the film stuff, the original footage, still exists, and it's been re-scanned in HD, and it looks beautiful. It looks as if it was filmed yesterday.
Wow.
Apart from the fact that it's in black and white. So you can get this on DVD and Blu-ray, and I think it looks remarkably good. There is a film version of Quatermass and the Pit from the late 60s, so about 10 years after this version. And the film is good, and a lot of people love the film, but for me, the original TV series is better in every way. It's 6 half-hour episodes, a lot more detail, a lot more substance to it, and it's very much a time capsule. You look at it and you really feel that you're being taken back to 1958. I don't know if it would work for anyone who isn't British, frankly, and I don't know if it would work for anyone who likes modern science fiction films with explosions and special effects, because it doesn't have that. But if you're interested in science fiction of the mind, it's pretty damn good.
I love how you explained it and the history of it. The fact that you like it and describe it so well makes me want to go back and see it and see what I think of it.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I used to enjoy watching the 1980s era Doctor Who with Tom Baker.
Right, yes. And it would look fairly similar to that, except black and white.
Yeah.
And in some ways more primitive than Doctor Who, because it was like 10 years before the Tom Baker, actually more than that, more like 15 or 20 years before the Tom Baker Doctor Who. But having said that, it had a lot more care put into it than Doctor Who did, in my opinion. Now, we've got all the Whovians writing in now and telling us how we're wrong.
Well, you know, we've reviewed books and we've talked about movie scripts. Maybe we should do a little bit of television watching. And I don't think we want to commit to watching an entire series for one episode, mm-hmm. but we could watch, you know, actually, for British TV, you could watch the entire series because you folks are reasonable and put 6 episodes or 8 episodes in your series.
That's right. What's the next on your list?
The next one would be Star Trek Voyager.
Okay. Yeah.
Through the 70s and the 80s and really up through the 90s and 2000s, I was a huge Star Trek fan. Not to the point of going to conventions and doing cosplay. But I read the books, I watched the movies, I grew up with the 4 series. I liked Voyager, although I know a lot of people didn't. But to me, it was still essentially Star Trek.
Yeah.
I know that after Gene Roddenberry passed away, that they tried to make changes to the series to make it, in order to try to make it more attractive to what they thought was a more modern audience. But one of the things that I started to lose was this idea that people would steadily get better and cultures would steadily get better over time. So there was more mm-hmm. conflict between people, which was probably more realistic. But yeah, you know, the ideals of the Federation and the United Federation of Planets and Starfleet, they kind of got lost, I think, in the service of more dramatic plotting. And that wasn't something that I enjoyed.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember when Voyager began. Actually, I happened to be in New York when it debuted. So I was able to watch it sort of live, as it were, when it first aired. And I was quite blown away with the first episode of Voyager. I think it went a bit flaky in the subsequent episodes, but then became very strong again much later on. Mm-hmm. But yeah, to me, it was very much Star Trek. It was boldly going, you know, in this case, they were boldly going back home, but still having to overcome adversity and meeting strange cultures and all of that. So it was much more Star Trek-y than Deep Space Nine had been.
One of the things I liked about it, again, because I tend to like an ethical show, I guess you could call it, one mm-hmm. with like morals, yeah. was despite the fact these people were stranded on the opposite side of the galaxy, they never stopped being Starfleet officers. They didn't interfere with cultures too much, unjustifiably. despite the fact they were technologically much more advanced in a lot of places, a lot of other cultures they came across, they didn't lord it over them or make sacrifices so that they could get home, even though they could have.
Yes. Very good. Very good. My second item, again, chronologically, moving on from the previous one, is 1959, and it's The Twilight Zone. Again, I was born, but I've seen it since. And of course, this is a classic case of American television shot on film in the first place to a very high standard with an incredible cinematographer, certainly on the early seasons of The Twilight Zone. And all of the film elements have been rescanned in high definition, so it looks far better today than it has ever looked, and it looks fantastic. Not everything in The Twilight Zone was great. If you count up the good episodes versus the bad episodes, it's probably something like 70% good stuff and 25 to 30% not overall, if you include all of the seasons. But the early shows, the first season, probably the first two seasons, some really, really good TV stuff. And some of it from the pen of Rod Serling, of course, who was the creator of the show, but also some great other writers on there. Richard Matheson wrote plenty of episodes, some of the best ones. Charles Beaumont wrote some of the episodes. Earl Hamner, who would later create The Waltons, wrote a number of episodes.
Wow.
So, you know, it's a really good, healthy mix of writers and directors as well. And I still think The Twilight Zone is not just one of the best TV science fiction series, it's one of the best TV series, full stop. Of course, it's an anthology, so every week a new story. So it's the equivalent of the science fiction short story. And the fact that every 20 years or so, they go back to it and try and remake it and recapture it, I think speaks volumes about what people see in that original show. But of course, nobody can do it. Nobody can quite do it as well as it was back in the late 50s and early 60s.
My next series would be Sequest DSV.
Hey.
And the thing that I really liked about it was that it was totally science fiction, but it was totally underwater here on Earth. And they would come up with these very science fiction-y stories, but they would all be underwater, you know, finding new life, conflicts between people, technological problems, sociological problems, but all done here, right down here, kind of down over there in one ocean or another. And I particularly, you know, again, I watched this when I was, you know, quite a bit younger. At the end of every episode, Bob Ballard would come in and talk about something about, you know, deep sea research or some aspect of this episode that was actually happening today. And it was it was very exciting to me. The thing it suffered from is a lot of cast conflict. So Roy Scheider was not happy about how the show changed over time, because they would do a season and then make a whole bunch of changes. And he didn't like the changes. And so he didn't last more than, I want to say, two seasons and a few episodes. And then he was replaced by Michael Ironside.
Oh, yes. Oh, I'd forgotten that. Yeah.
So there was some genetic engineering that happened. There was, which brought up discussions of race and slavery and ableness versus disabledness and lots of really interesting topics.
I saw some of it, but I wasn't drawn to it. There was nothing there for me. But I think that's true of a lot of underwater things. So I remember seeing Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea as a kid, because I think my dad used to watch that, and I just couldn't see any point in it. These people in a submarine are just traveling around under the sea. What's to watch? And later on, you had what was he called? The Man from Atlantis. Do you remember him?
I do.
Patrick Duffy.
Yes. I liked that show. So, it was on, you know, when I was fairly young. I don't think it lasted very long.
No, no. But I think every kid wanted to be able to swim like Patrick Duffy did.
Oh, totally. You know,
that sort of fishtail waggle that he did.
Yes. Now, were your parents into science fiction? Were they the people that introduced you to it?
I wouldn't say they were into it, but I think it was just one of those things that happened to be on. You know, like there would be Westerns, there would be detective shows, there would be science fiction shows. And I think they weren't bothered they wanted to watch things that they enjoyed, but they weren't bothered what genre it was. Mm-hmm. It's funny that there were some science fiction things that really appealed to me as a kid and others that left me totally cold. And I, growing up, sort of saw those as being, well, those must be adult science fiction shows. But when I've gone back to them later, I've realized that, no, they're still not very interesting. Anyway, my third item is from 1966, and it's a little-known show. You've probably never heard of this one. It's called Star Trek. No Next Generation, no Deep Space Nine, no A, B, or C, or whatever it is that Scotty says in one of the Star Trek films. Just Star Trek, as it was called. I'm sure I've spoken about this on the show before. I don't particularly remember the first time I saw Star Trek, but I do remember it being a part of my childhood. And I do know, just as from having looked at the history of it, I do know that in the UK we didn't get Star Trek until it had almost finished production. In fact, it may have gone out of production before it was shown in the UK. So the earliest I could possibly have seen it would have been, I think, 1969. But whether I saw it in first run or not, I don't know. But ever since it was first shown in the UK, it was on constantly. It was on constant rotation, sometimes in the evenings, sometimes in children's programming in the morning or in school holiday TV programming. So it's always been part of my life, if you like. And I know that Star Trek is unusual in that it started out pretty damn good. If you look at the first season of Star Trek, there's barely a dull episode. They're nearly all very strong episodes. Season two is about half good and half weak. Season three is barely worth talking about, frankly. But it's an unusual series that started really well and sustained for about 50% of its lifespan. And it's great. And it's spawned so many things since. And I don't know what it is that first attracted me to Star Trek. I think it was the fact that they were meeting new cultures, new people, new aliens. And I know that as an adult, what appeals to me about Star Trek is that one of the principal things is that you'll have a story where it appears that something is happening, such as it appears that a monster is killing miners down in the mine. But it will turn out that, no, that alien is not a monster. It's doing something for its own good reason. So, yeah, Star Trek TOS.
I'm going to head over to Star Wars now.
Okay.
Star Wars The Clone Wars, the animated series.
Oh, yes.
Which for its, I want to say, eight seasons over 15 years, delivers to me the same kind of thing that, Star Trek and some of the other series did. It was very episodic. There were some overarching plots and themes that happened throughout the entire thing.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that the series was hemmed in the beginning and the end by being between two movies. So you knew that that Anakin Skywalker was going to fall and become Darth Vader. Mm-hmm. And you knew how he started with this, little Padawan named Ahsoka, who's become one of the most beloved Star Wars characters ever.
Yeah.
Her standalone series, the live action one, comes out in June. So it'll be interesting to see what Dave Filoni does with that.
Yeah.
But the fact that it would, hop not linearly in time, but, go toward the end of the time that it was allowed to work in and go back to the beginning of the time and stitch things together and make callbacks between them. I just really enjoyed. Mm. Plus, it was Star Wars, and I like Star Wars.
Yeah, I do remember watching some of those episodes when they first came out. but I didn't feel that I knew Star Wars well enough to cope with a kind of an adjunct part of the Star Wars universe. Do you know what I mean? It's like, for me, it would be like picking up the 10th book in a series. And I know that I would have no hope in understanding what's going on because I haven't read the 9 books before it. Mm-hmm. I have now seen all of the Star Wars films, but I haven't seen any of the TV stuff at all, apart from a couple of episodes of Clone Wars. I still haven't seen any Mandalorian, for example. And that's, there's no value judgment there. It's just I haven't got round to it yet. I will do one day.
You mentioned liking anthology series. Yeah. And Star Trek, the original series, which we both like, my announcement's coming up, is they tend to be like an anthology series.
Yes.
The slang today is it's the monster of the week format.
Yeah.
You have an episode. This episode has its moral, its plot, its character development, whatever one thing it does. And then the next episode is almost completely untouched by the previous one.
Yeah.
In something like The Clone Wars, it doesn't totally do that because after Babylon 5, people started writing science fiction differently, where it would tend to be, there'd be like a series long arc or a 4 or 5 episode long arc, and characters would change and there would be consequences that would lead from this on to other ones.
Yeah.
This happened in Star Trek The Next Generation, I want to say in season 6, with the way they rewrote warp travel.
Yes.
That was carried forward into future seasons. But that kind of an idea was very, very new. And to me, Clone Wars kind of carries the best of all those things together.
You're absolutely right that even when shows were not strictly anthology series, they often had an anthology approach, which enabled people to drop into a series at any point and not have to be burdened with trying to figure out what the backstory was. Now, obviously, we live in different times, but I still think there is a case for having some television that does that. And there's a case for having some television that has continuous stories. And probably for me, the strongest is a series that does a bit of both. A series which has a season arc, but that nevertheless allows you to enjoy each episode on its own merits without having to worry too much about the season arc. Which brings me to item number 4 on my list, which is such a show. And it's from 1967. And it's The Prisoner. Now, I thought about, is this science fiction or is it something else? And I could argue it either way. Frankly, I don't mind whether you consider it science fiction or not. But I think there are enough science fiction elements in The Prisoner as a whole that it counts as science fiction. And I think it is certainly exploring ideas in a science fiction way. And I don't know if have you seen it, Colin? Do you know The Prisoner?
I know the premise of it.
Yeah.
And I want to say I've watched an episode, but that's about it.
Okay. I mean, it's one of those things that's not going to be everyone's cup of tea. It's very much of the 60s. It's the swinging 60s. It's very colorful, very British. Filmed in a location which looks quite otherworldly, but which actually is the grounds of a hotel in Wales. But the basic premise for anyone who's not familiar with it is that we have someone who we believe to have been a spy who worked for the British government. He resigns for reasons that we do not know, and his employers don't know why he's resigned. And rather than him being allowed to resign, he is gassed and he wakes up in this strange place, the village, and he doesn't know where he is. He wants to escape. He appears to be captive, but everybody treats him as if he's a guest. And it's a fascinating show about the lengths somebody will go to try to restore their freedom. So it's a show which could be used to argue a left-wing viewpoint or a right-wing viewpoint. It's ambiguous on so many levels that it can appeal to you for so many contradictory reasons. What I like about it the most is that it builds in such a way that it becomes weirder and weirder towards the end, and eventually it ends spoilers with the prisoner escaping after a very bizarre trial. So it's a bit like experimental theatre in the last couple of episodes. Some really powerful performances from Patrick McGoohan, who is the star and the co-creator and co-writer and co-director of the series, and some other actors who are magnificent in the final few episodes as well. It's a series that I watch over and over again, and I've bought it multiple times. You know, I bought it when it came out on DVD, and then they put out a Blu-ray version, so I bought that as well. It's another show that there was an attempt to remake it, I think in the early 2000s, and the remake was just terrible. They kind of missed the point. And it's one of these where it's such an iconic show. The elements that make it are so unique that you cannot possibly redo it. So don't even try. But it's really very good. Harlan Ellison once described it as being a novel for television. So although it is made up of episodes which could be watched more or less in any order, apart from the first one and the last couple, it does have a continuous arc. So it is more like a novel than it is an anthology format.
Interesting. Mm. Yeah, you almost describe it like science fiction Play-Doh, where you can, you know, mold it to your own interpretations and stuff.
Yeah, very much.
My next series would be Person of Interest.
Oh.
Have you heard of this?
I think I have, but I've never seen it.
It hits a lot of high notes for me. One is it's a redemption story.
Right.
It starts off with this homeless man who stops a crime and rescues a guy. And it turns out the guy he rescues has been surreptitiously doing good deeds and stopping bad deeds from happening because he has invented this program which will tell him when they're going to happen. It's almost predictive in nature.
Right.
And so in that way, it's science fiction. It's very science fiction light, kind of like Knight Rider or Airwolf.
Right.
Although the vehicle isn't the main part of the story. It's and the computer program is the inception of every story.
Mm-hmm.
But over the seasons, it becomes more and more science fiction-y because it turns out that the program that Mr. Finch wrote is an artificial intelligence. And then it becomes this examination about the consequences of internet surveillance and privacy and artificial intelligence and what the rights of artificial intelligence would be versus our rights, mm-hmm. and how the two would interact.
I had no idea that that's what it was about, you know. I think I'd just seen a title and kind of assumed that it was a crime investigation type story. Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. Yeah, I watched it. Yeah, I watched it twice. I would recommend it to people wholeheartedly. It has excellent actors whose names I can't recall off the top of my head. But yeah, I would highly recommend it. Now, what I'm doing is I'm synthesizing, you know, many years of something down to its most dense representation. And so it's like I said, it's loosely science fiction and it increases over time.
Right. Yeah.
So it would take a while for you to warm. It may take a while for people to warm up to it, is what I'm saying.
Okay. I like that there are some real surprises in these lists. Well, there's surprises in your list. Obviously, I'm not surprised by my own list, but maybe you're surprised by some of the things in my list. I don't know. But
The Quatermass.
Yeah.
This is pretty cool.
Yeah. Okay. My fifth item is again, carrying on chronologically, we're now into the 70s. And I was alive when this one was on. I mean, I was born in the 60s, so anything from the 60s onwards, I could technically have seen, possibly. But this one I definitely saw on first viewing. This is a BBC series which ran for 3 years, and it's called Survivors. And it was created by Terry Nation, who is the guy who created Daleks for Doctor Who. And the premise of the series is that there is a global pandemic and the global population is, I'm going to say, decimated, which I think technically means cut down to about 10%, something like mm-hmm. that. So essentially, it's like the Black Death has come back, but even more so. And the whole of civilization collapses because of this pandemic. But what the show is really about is about surviving. So it's how are these people who have survived, how are they going to cope with that? They will have, some of them, survivor guilt. They will have the inability to cope, some of them. Others will think that they are supremely suited for coping and for becoming leaders of a new world order. And so you get the potential for enormous conflict among these, that a handful of people in England who have survived. And I say in England because although it's a global pandemic, we just follow a handful of characters who eventually meet up and decide to work together to try and, well, stay alive initially, but also to try and rebuild civilization. And the show, it is mostly of a sort of anthology format, apart from the beginning episode and the end episode, which do give it a complete arc. So you could watch episodes jumbled up to an extent. But each season has a different feel and flavour and kind of a season arc to it, which is largely due to the fact that there were changes in the production team. But the first season is largely about this idea that if you wanted to rebuild civilization, how could you possibly do it? You've got a car. What are you going to do when it runs out of petrol? There is no petrol left. Well, maybe you could adapt the car to run off something else, like methane. But what are you going to do when one of the pistons goes in the car? Can you manufacture a piston? And what happens if the tool that you need to make a piston also breaks? Can you manufacture a machine that is used to manufacture pistons? And that's the thrust of the whole of the first season. How much of our civilization do we as individuals have the ability to maintain or restore? The second season is much more about self-sufficiency and survival of communities. And then the third season is about restoring power to the nation, which involves turning on a hydroelectric power station so that we have electricity again and we can run all of our machines, just like the old days. So it ran for 3 years and I was enthralled every single week when this was on. And I've watched it again and again over the years and it holds up remarkably well. And there's a few duff episodes, but it's mostly a really good series. Very well written, very well performed. It looks cheap because it's BBC and it's 70s. But if you can get over that, it's still a great series. Again, there have been attempts to remake it. There was one in the 2000s, which completely missed the point and was fairly terrible. There is actually an audio version of Survivors. There's a company in the UK called Big Finish who do Doctor Who audio dramas. And they've run an audio version of Survivors for a number of years. And they've basically designed episodes that fit in between the TV episodes. So they kind of filled in some of the gaps in the mythology of Survivors. And those are really good as well. So I highly recommend those. But Survivors, the original series, is an absolute staple for me. And if I were doing a top 10 with one show sitting at number one, it might well be Survivors.
Wow.
But it might be Star Trek. Have you heard of it?
No. Although I think I did hear about the remake. It never ceases to amaze me, the process of adaptation, which is really what a 20 or 30 year remake is.
Yes.
Most people don't want to reshoot that series shot for shot like it was in the 70s with modern technology, which would be a canonical adaptation or remake. They always want to bring in new things from today.
Yeah.
And there's some point where it either worked at that time in that way, or people have a different interpretation than the popular one, I want to say.
Yeah, I think generally it's a mistake to be drawn to something, to want to remake it, and then not consider what are the things that made it great in the first place. I think just saying, oh, that show was great, we'll take some elements of it and we'll do our own thing, I think that is highly suspect and is cheating as a creator. Mm. You're cheating if you're doing that. Come up with something original of your own. Or go to that thing that you think was good, figure out why it was good, and then work with that. And there have been examples of that. There's the revival of Battlestar Galactica did it, for me, absolutely right. They took the best parts of the original Galactica and then did their own thing with it. But they at least respected what the strength was in the original piece, in my opinion. And the first season of Westworld, I think, was like that as well. Obviously, Westworld is remaking a film, and they could have done it in a direct way, but they took the central premise of a kind of a robotic theme park, but then ran with that premise in some other direction, a different philosophical direction, but with the same basic physical premise, if you like. And that worked because they respected what it was that made the original appealing. But there are too many shows which have just been going back to the same well because we can't think of anything else to do. And that's creatively bankrupt.
Yeah.
Are you about halfway through your list?
I am.
Because so am I. I wonder whether we should make this our first ever two-part episode.
Oh, we could do that.
So next time we record, we could do the other half.
And it's entirely possible that over a couple of weeks, my top five will shift around a little bit too.
But nobody will know.
Nobody will know.
So we're about halfway through now. I've done five. Colin, I think you've done five now. Mm-hmm. So listeners, we're going to pause there and we're going to continue with our top tens in our next episode. And today we're going to move on with our quiz. I have a quiz here which is taken from the internet. I wanted to find a quiz that was about TV science fiction in particular, but I also wanted something where both of us would have some familiarity with the subject matter. So this comes from a website called paulsquiz.com, and he's got hundreds of quizzes. I don't know who Paul is, but all due respect to Paul for creating hundreds of quizzes. And what I've done is I've taken his science fiction film and TV quiz. I've taken out the film questions and I've whittled it down to about 10 questions about TV. So, question one. Which TV series was based on the novel Cyborg by Martin Kadin?
The $6 Million Man.
Correct. Next question. Which former Mr. World and Mr. Universe played the part of the Hulk in The Incredible Hulk?
Lou Ferrigno.
Correct. Next question. In which century does Star Trek take place? And we'll assume we're talking about Star Trek, the original series.
Oh, I should know this off the top of my head. Isn't it the 24th century?
The 23rd century. So it's basically 300 years on from when it was made. Next question. What was the name of the atomic submarine in the TV series Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea?
That one I don't know.
That was the Seaview.
Seaview. Okay.
Yeah. Which former Miss USA played the part of Wonder Woman?
Linda Carter.
Of course. Where would you regularly see the code NCC-1701?
Back to the Star Trek universe. That's on the Enterprise.
Correct.
Technically, it is the Enterprise. One of them, anyway.
What was the name of Blake Seven's first ship?
Oh. Now, see, we're back to British science fiction, and I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, it was the Liberator. Another British one now, but I think you should know this one. Who was the fourth Doctor Who on TV?
The fourth.
Yep. And I can give you a clue if you need one.
I'll take that clue, please.
You have already mentioned the Fourth Doctor.
Okay, that's Mr. Baker.
It is Tom Baker, correct. The next question. What was the name of George Jetson's dog?
There was Judy and Elmo and the dog. I have forgotten. I don't know.
It's Astro.
Astro, yeah. I don't remember the name of the maid.
You don't remember who?
The name of the maid.
Oh, the maid. Yeah. No, me neither. Which character makes a series of quantum leaps?
That would be Dr. Sam Beckett in Quantum Leap.
Correct. And the next one. Which actress played the equivalent of the $6 million man?
Lindsay Wagner from right across the river from where I live.
Oh, really? Well, you should wave to her from your window.
Yeah, in fact, I know somebody that went to school with her.
Oh, wow. And then I believe this is the last question. What is futile against the Borg?
Resistance.
Correct. So you got most of them. I think there were three that you didn't get. But nevertheless, you got a good, healthy score there. You now have a degree in science fiction television. So, shall we finish off with past, present, and future?
Yes.
So, I have a past item, which is, it's going to take me a long time to say this, but it's a very simple concept, but it's justifying how this is even science fiction. Back in the day, in the 80s and 90s in particular, I used to record radio dramas off air. I was as hooked on radio dramas as I am on film and TV. And it was an art form that was easily lost because there's not much radio drama going on in the world. The BBC still does a bit. And back in the 80s, they did a lot more than they do now. And there was this real sense that if you heard a radio play, you would never hear it again because they didn't repeat them. So I used to collect them. If there was ever a science fiction piece done, I would be there with a tape. I'd be recording the show off air and keeping it. Now, long ago, I went into the format of mini-disc. I don't know if you're familiar with mini-disc. It's like a CD, but smaller.
Yeah.
It's re-recordable. And it looked, in the late 90s, early 2000s, it looked as if that was going to be the future of audio, was the mini-disc. But then along came iPods and stuff. I've still got all of these discs with my recordings on from the 80s and the 90s. And I could listen to them whenever I want, but I don't want most of the time. It's too much hassle to dig out the mini-disc player. But somebody's done a clever thing where you can now, if you have the right player, you can now make faster than real-time digital transfers from the disc onto a computer. This is something that was not technologically possible before because the manufacturers made it so you couldn't do that because they didn't want people pirating stuff. But it's now possible with the right technology and the right bit of software. So I'm going to embark on rescuing those dramas.
Interesting.
It's science fiction only in that the content of many of these discs that I've got, and I've got a couple of hundred of them, many of them are science fiction content.
Well, I was wondering, we've talked in the past about how some of the earlier, especially BBC and American recordings were lost because they would record over the same magnetic tape over and over.
Oh, yeah.
And some things are gone forever. Is that the case in these audio dramas where they were, you know, broadcast once and then there's no archive of them any place for people that want to listen to them in the future?
Once you get into the 90s, they do tend to keep the recordings. But before the 90s, yeah, they were routinely wiping stuff. But once you got into the 90s, and I think it was when they started to realize that there was a commercial value in some of this material. Plus, they started their own kind of archive radio station where they would re-air some of these old things. Having said that, I don't think I own anything that is unique. You know, I think there are copies out in the world, but it's possible that some of the things I've got, nobody else has a copy of.
I think that's very cool.
What have you got for a past item?
I don't have any past items, but I have a present item.
Okay.
So April 1st was the release date for the next installment of Brandon Sanderson's record-breaking Kickstarter, Five Secret Novels. And this one was called The Frugal Wizard's Handbook for Surviving Medieval England.
Wow.
Which is a very Sandersonian title. And I was looking forward to a little fantasy as a break from, you know, hardcore science fiction.
Yeah.
Only to find that I think he has actually done both at the same time. So it's relatively new still, so I don't want to do too many spoilers. But I want to say that, you know, if you're a fan of Reese's peanut butter cups, if you like getting your chocolate and your peanut butter mixed up, if you like Christopher Stashiff's A Wizard in Spite of Himself.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Which is about a it's a future science fiction novel about a guy that goes to a planet with people who have psionic abilities, including telepathy, only to find that there's actually some magic involved too. What I've read has been very enjoyable so far. I'm looking forward to finishing it.
You've been enthusing about the potential of these books for a long time. So it's good that you've actually got your hands on one of them now. Are these available to everyone now, or is it just people who were contributors to the Kickstarter?
The people who contributed to the Kickstarter get early releases. And then within 2 to 3 months of that release, they are being released. There's a mass market edition. You can buy the special editions. And of course, the audiobooks and the ebooks later as well.
Very good. My present item is, again, it's only tangentially science fiction. But as we record this, yesterday was the first attempt by SpaceX to launch its Starship. And I think anything that's called a Starship, that's got to be science fiction, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So yesterday we had a new phrase enter the language, and this is one I'm going to be using regularly. The phrase is rapid unscheduled disassembly, which is SpaceX longhand for it blew up.
It went boom.
I don't know about you, but I was watching it live. What was weird was the SpaceX commentators talking about this as if this was the most joyous occasion of all time. That, oh, we've learned so much from this. And I wanted to say to them, hold on a minute, you do realize it just blew up.
Yeah, I mean, you can be disappointed by a failure and then learn from it and then pull something positive out of it. But if you don't have that initial uh-oh, then I think you're spreading too much on top of it.
But it was really good to see the thing lifting off, you know. And as always with a massive rocket, they seem to move so slowly.
I wonder if it was a payload problem, like they put in too many protein bars.
Ah, could be. Have you got any future items?
I'll talk more about this, I think, next time we talk and record this the other half of this episode. But I'm looking forward to the Ahsoka Star Wars series coming out in June.
Okay. I've got two future items here. I've got one, which is a rather cryptic social media post yesterday from J. Michael Straczynski, who's the creator of Babylon 5. He posted this. Nothing to do with the reboot / reimagining. Oh, and he posted the Babylon 5 logo as part of the post. Uh-huh. Nothing to do with the reboot reimagining, and everything to do with the project that we've been working on in secret for almost 2 years. Exactly 2 weeks from today, start watching the skies. The landing will happen in several stages. And then he put in a little quote from 2010, which is, what's going to happen? Something wonderful. So obviously the internet is now abuzz over what the hell he was talking about. Is this some reinvention of Babylon 5? Is it a re-release, a sort of a remastering of the original? Or is it something to do with 2010? Nobody knows. So it's a nice little science fiction mystery. We only have to wait 2 weeks to find out, but it's got me on tenterhooks. I hope it's going to be something interesting.
I wonder if it's related to The Last Dangerous Visions.
I thought that initially, because he has been working on that for a couple of years. However, he posted it with, the post was accompanied by the Babylon 5 logo, which makes me think it must be tied to that in some way. But who knows?
We'll find out in 2 weeks.
We will. And then the other future item is tinged with disappointment. It's the announcement fairly recently that Chris Hadfield's next book is, well, it's been announced for October, and it's called The Defector. Of course, his previous novel was The Apollo Murders, which we rather liked here on the podcast. His new novel is called The Defector, but from everything he's said about it so far, it's not science fiction. I was hoping for a space shuttle murders or the ISF murders.
I had an idea for a science fiction story that I've never followed up on, because every time I try to put the plot around the idea, I can't get anything to coalesce and have it make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something very simple. I'll mention it some other time.
Oh, okay. You'll have to, whatever it is, write it and then do a crowdfunder to put it out. Do you have any other future items?
Nope, I think that's it for now.
Okay, I think we'll draw to a close for today. Don't forget, next time we will continue with our top tens of favourite science fiction TV series. So thanks for listening. We're Phil Nichols and Colin Kusky. Our theme tune is from purpleplanet.com. Check out the show notes at 101sf.blogspot.com, where you can also leave us a comment or a tip in the tip jar. And don't forget to give us a nice 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you get your podcasts. See you next time.